Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of mind power. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, I hope that this day, Pearl Harbor Day, you have the opportunity to express your appreciation for those who are in the military, who stand always in a positioning of defending our rights of freedom and upholding what they feel is the American dream. Well, because it is Pearl Harbor Day, I wanted to be able to feature a couple of people that are going to share with us some material that they've written. And my first guest today is Rosalie T. Turner. And she is a woman that has written a book from a perspective that not too many people have even ventured to touch, and that is the spouse of an officer or of men and women of valor, but this one is called Sisters of Valor. It is about those that stay behind to keep the home fires burning. And Alma Powell, the wife of General Colonel Powell, she said, "This book evokes poignant memories. They also serve who only stand and wait." These words from the 17th century English writer John Milton describe our lives as military wives. Our silent service to our country resonates throughout the years. I want to welcome the author, Rosalie T. Turner. Rosalie, I'm so glad you're able to join me today on this significant day of remembrance for our country. Thank you for being my guest today.
Well, thank you for having me, Donna.
Now, you're an interesting woman. You describe yourself as primarily a stay-at-home mom, and the social work arena has been something that you've been very interested in. You've worked with Head Start, Habitat for Humanity, a jail ministry. You've worked with the homeless. You've taught literacy and English as a second language to adults. You've been anything but a quiet stay-at-home mom. I mean, you're quite a gal. You've tutored children. You've set up reading programs in the inner city. You've received all kinds of awards, including the J.C. Penney Golden Rule Award, and that's the highest award nationally given for community service, and also the Jacksonville, Florida Literacy Coalition Volunteer of the Year Award. When in the world did you ever find time to write?
Well, I didn't write until later years, really. Those are the things I tried to do as our kids were growing up and I was at home, and I still am enjoying doing now.
Now, you wrote this book because you wanted to give a perspective of service wives. Now, you yourself had a husband who served in Vietnam. You've also had a brother and then a son who served as a Marine in Iraq. Is he still on active duty?
No, he's just recently gotten off, and he is now in the police academy in Durham, North Carolina.
Oh, for heaven's sakes. Well, I want to ask you a question. This is about four women. Who did you base these characters on?
Well, when I first thought about the book, I kind of based Susan on a woman we knew. Her husband was my husband's CO when they were in the Marine Corps together. He was killed in Vietnam, and the book is in dedicated to his memory, Corky Ram. But as I wrote it, it sort of evolved into just sort of a composite of people. I'm sure there's a little bit of myself in some of them, except perhaps Magda. But just sort of a composite. The gunny's wife is a little bit like a gunny's wife I remembered well.
Now, when you were putting this book together about these four women, they're very different from each other, what motivated you to put this in the format that you did? Because these women had a very strong interaction. Was it something that you personally had experienced yourself? Or, again, did you just take it from maybe conversations from different people and weave this story.
Well, it wasn't something that I experienced. I wish I had had a sisterhood like that when my husband was overseas, but I didn't. But I think it's because I really believe in the sisterhood of women, that women really pull together and support each other when they need to, and they help to nurture each other. And I think that's something that we see across the board in any situation with women. And so I wanted to incorporate that idea along with the idea of what the service wife goes through. And by having the four different women, it brought more of a cross-section of women into it, so that I think any service wife who reads this will find something in it where she says, that was me, that's my story.
Well, I think what's so significant, too, is that each of these women have so much that frightens them, and by having their sisterhood, I'll use your words, they find that there is an alliance. They don't have to be alone. They have a chance to vent safely, and they are supportive of each other, because one of the women in the story, her husband is killed. And so this gives something of support. It gives so much of an insight into the world of women. Have you had many men want to read this? And if you did have them read it, what was their response?
Well, it has surprised me that I have. A number of Vietnam veterans have especially have read it and have really liked reading it. They said, I had no idea what it was like for my spouse while I was gone. You know, I just never thought about it from her perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And it really has kind of helped open up that idea. And then also, it was launched on Memorial Day up at our Vietnam Veterans Memorial
mm-hmm.
here in Angel Fire, New Mexico. And there's a lot of veterans that come for that event. One man came up to us and he said, I've been married for 42 years and I've never been able to talk to my wife about what happened to me in Vietnam, and she's never asked me anything. He said, if I have read this book, it would have opened up a dialogue between us and helped a lot. And he finally has gotten psychological help to help him deal with what he went through in Vietnam.
I'm so glad that you've brought that up, because I think one of the areas that most people are very unaware of is that whenever you have been in combat, that stays with you all of your life. It never disappears. There's no
right.
There's no magic wand. You have that vividness, all of your training that you've gone through. And when a woman who is married to a man in the military, and I would say it's also for the husbands who are married to women who are in the military.
Right.
Because on either side, they're still going through the same kind of training. They're still facing death every day. They are still looking at how they've got to keep themselves mentally alert, and they have to have a type of clarity. And when they come away from that, it's really very hard, because coming back into civilian life, that's a different world. And they have been in another world that, in the view of most of us, it would be pretty dark.
Absolutely. And interestingly enough, too, the spouses at home change, too. And so there are different people coming back together, and it's very hard sometimes for couples to adapt to each other again. And so I think nowadays they're doing a lot more about families for service people, helping them find the support that they need and the counseling to be available when they get back.
It's very, very traumatic. No, during the Second World War, I've known some veterans, and it is exceptionally difficult for them.
Yes.
To talk about it, because the environment that they were brought up in was one, no matter how ugly things got, what you did was just stuff it in, stuff it down, stuff it away, and you were not to complain. This wasn't something to deal with. And each of your characters, Susan, Magda, Rose, and Texan, each of them have various situations that they deal with. And it's really a challenge for them because you represent them in today's world, and they're so much more fortunate than the women, I think, that were the wives of the soldiers after the Second World War, because you were supposed to be Miss Perfect Wife and not ever have to talk about anything. And I knew some women when I was growing up, and the agonies that they went through because they didn't have anybody to talk to.
That's right. That was such a different generation.
Yes, very much so. When you pulled this information together, Sisters of Valor, what did you find was your most challenging position in this book so that when people read it, they could really be able to relate? What was the most challenging part of putting this material together?
Well, the women's part was not hard, but, you know, I have the action go to the husbands in Vietnam, so you get an idea of what is going on with them also. And I had researched that a lot, but I used my husband as a sounding board for that. When I first wrote it, and he read that part, he said, well, this is, you know, very authentic, except for the way they talk. He said, you don't have a single bit of profanity in this, and that's not how it was. So I had to go in and add the profanity, and that was challenging for me.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because that is a different world.
It was very different.
So it's wonderful. Your husband was supportive of that.
Oh, very.
When you put those images in, you had a section in your book, and it was the character Susan. She said, I've got to face and deal with something, and that was the potential loss of her husband. She said, why does it upset me so much? Is it just because the protest movement is hurling hurtful insults at our servicemen and women, or is it something deeper? Is it because it makes us feel that we can no longer trust our leaders? Maybe it's the judgment it makes against the way we've chosen our life's direction. Those are very poignant questions. Were those questions that you felt?
Well, I think so. As you mentioned earlier, not only my husband but my brother also served in Vietnam, and my two sisters were very active in the protest movement. And so when it was so close to home, it did make you really question, you know, why are they against this, and what is my real view about it? And that was very challenging and difficult.
You have another section of comment by the women when they're communicating with each other, and it's between Susan and Texan. She said, I do not begin to understand about war. I can't get how fighting for freedom gets down to one man shooting to kill another man. I suspect that if it were left up to the women, there would be no wars. And those are words I know that are felt in the hearts of the wives of those that are serving overseas, and also in the hearts, well, I don't know about the hearts of the men, because they think about things differently than the women do. But it's a wonderful book. Your perspectives here are so warm. They're so current. And I think that this holiday season, this is something that if you're wanting to give a gift to a person who's got a loved one that's overseas, I think that Rosalie has captured something very special. Today's Pearl Harbor Day, and it's a day that is very significant in American history. It touched the lives of millions that went around the world and its effect. And I think it's important for us to remember those who have been before us and also those that are currently representing this great nation of ours. Rosalie Turner, you have a website that people can go to, sistersofvalor.com, is that correct?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Well, Rosalie, I want to thank you for being my guest today, and I wish you the greatest of success with your book, Sisters of Valor.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Donna. I really enjoyed visiting with you.
It's been a pleasure. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be bringing on our second guest in just a moment. And our guest is with us right at this time. We are going to go to Mr. D. Schiavi, and his book is The Eternal Soldier, and his subtitle is Old Soldiers Don't Die, and They Never Fade Away. Mr. D. Schiavi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. Now, your book, The Diary of the Eternal Soldier, you have had some phenomenal experiences. When I was reviewing your book, going through it, I just felt in many ways as if I was right there going through your experience. So I want my audience to know about you. Your first name is Armand. You're one of the two remaining survivors from the 390th Bomb Group, Combat Crew number 24. You were imprisoned at Stalag 17B in Krems, Austria from 1944 through 1945. And for you to live to tell your story is really something. And I remember you're telling me how your daughter had to nag you about this. Tell us about Stalag 17B.
Well, I think I was very fortunate to be in Stalag 17B. We were treated well. The YMCA supplied us with all the necessities for sports, for clothing, and of course not for food because that was handled by the Red Cross. But we had baseball teams, we had prize fighting, we had a band we called Paul Baker and His Boys. And then we had a theater that we called the Cardboard Playhouse. And the reason for that name was because every parcel of food that the GIs got, we just saved them, opened them up, and then stapled them to a wall. And we had many artists in the camp. Don't forget, we were 4,164 prisoners of war, non-commissioned officers. And we had men of many skills. So they had painted the scenes concerning a certain play that had to be played for that weekend. And then it would be all new cardboard and new scenery made. And so we kept going like that. And that's where the movie Stalag 17 started, with Don Bevins and Trzynski, who both wrote that movie.
And eventually it was made into a series. It was a comedy
Absolutely.
Series on television that was quite successful for a number of years.
Yes.
Now, yeah, in your putting this together, I remember you're telling me when I chatted with you to book you for today's show that your daughter had really hounded you about getting this book done. Why was it that it was such a difficulty for you to write this book?
Well, I always felt, what is the sense of telling people what I did in the service? Nobody is interested. And I based that on the fact that when I returned in 1945, and when people began to ask little things about what I did in the war, as I was about to explain it to them, they would quickly interrupt and say, oh, we had a bad time also. We couldn't get sugar. We had to stand on line for gasoline. It was really tough. So I didn't bother to talk anymore. I says, well, they had it worse than we did, the way they saying it. And that's why I never wanted to say anything. But when I got home, I still had my uniform in the closet. And my daughter would wear it to school. She was so interested since a little girl.
Wow.
And she kept telling me, Dad, you should put this down on paper. I says, Jeanette, please. Well, finally, in 2007, a conversation came up between my daughter and I, because we're very close. And the war was the subject. And she said, quickly, you see that, Dad? I didn't know that about you. And I didn't know the other thing about you. That's what I mean. You have to put it on paper. And so I said, okay. And that's when we started. I started in May of 2007. And the book was published July of 2009. Took us a little over 2 years to do it. I used to write it longhand, mail it to her in California, She would type it, edit, put it on a computer, shoot it over to me. I would copy it, and that's what we did. And to make the book perfect as far as spelling and grammar was concerned, we did 13 editions.
Wow.
As soon as we finished one, and we would read it to each other over the telephone, and we'd pick up little things here and there. So I'd say, well, all right, on page so-and-so, do this. On page so-. She said, forget it, Dad, it's too much. Let's do it over again. And we did. And we did that 13 times. And
13
finally the book came out.
13 is a lucky number. Wonderful.
Yes.
Now, this book is not written in a fictitious format. This book is actually based on experiences that you recorded in a diary that
yeah.
you kept. And there's going to be a special aspect regarding this war logbook, as you called it. Now, one of the things that you mentioned in my previous guest today, we were talking a little bit about this, said when you were doing this, it enabled you to release the bad memories that had haunted you for, what, 65 years?
Yes.
And you said, and I'm quoting you from the book, it's like cleaning out a cluttered closet after many years of storing unwanted items.
That's right.
And I also was amazed that you found out after you saw your brother in a documentary film about the D-Day invasion.
Right.
You saw your brother in the footage and he was shooting at snipers, and that, at that time, I don't know how old you were, but that really put you into PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome. What was that like for you?
Well, you know, I kept looking at all the war pictures, and my wife kept telling me, why do you want to see them over and over again? And my answer was, to me, all the soldiers were my brothers. We lived together like a tight-knit family. We knew each other's habits. We knew everything about each other. We were closer than brothers at home. And so I feel for every soldier, when I see the movie, especially in the Pacific, how those soldiers endured that fighting, it was horrible. I would feel the pain just sitting down watching it.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I endured my own pain, they've also endured it. And I feel for them. And I'm the soldier that can feel for them. An outsider can only see it and comment on it, and that's all. It means nothing else to them. And so I kept looking because, first of all, I had five brothers in the war. Every one of us was on the combat field. My oldest brother was killed in French Morocco, one of the first men to land on foreign soil. And that was 1942. And I dedicated my book to him.
Mm-hmm.
And this brother that I saw was in the commandos. He hit the beaches first before the rest of them came. And as I was looking at all of these war pictures, I kept thinking, I'm bound to see one of my brothers doing this or that or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then what do you know? I'm looking at the History Channel, and on there I see my... I only saw him from his back, but I knew it was my brother Rudy. Shooting that rifle. And I quickly called my niece, his daughter, who lives on the West Coast here, and she ordered the tape. So then she had a tape made for me, so we both have a tape now. It's only for a few seconds, but still, it hits home. And you know, the government, I always carry that with me. Not one person showed up at my father's house to ring the doorbell and say, I want to shake your hand and thank you and congratulate you for giving up five sons. He only had five sons and gave them all up to the war. Nobody ever said thank you. And that's a grudge I carry with me all the time, and I still do.
Where in your book you describe about training and all of the various things that you went through as a young man, you give such a wonderful description of the time itself and what it took to be able to be prepared. And it's really important, I think, that you have done this book in as much as it, if it were shared with a younger person, they would be able to get an idea with the photographs and all of the different records that you have represented here, what it took for someone to really qualify to be a trained soldier. It was really something.
Yes, because at first everybody said, you know, within 3 months they'll train you and send you to the combat field. Well, I found that not to be true. They trained me for 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
For 1 year before they shipped me overseas to combat. Now, the pilots were what we call 90-day wonders, because within 90 days they became pilots and second lieutenants. But they knew nothing about the airplane. They just knew how to fly. So that's where the flight engineer, which was my job, to stand up behind the pilot and co-pilot on that bomber and watch all the instruments.
Your facts and information about a plane that I think is just a phenomenal plane, that's the B-17.
The B-17, yes.
And that was yours. And I want to just share with my audience the description you give of this flying fortress. Now, it was built by Boeing here in Seattle, Washington.
Oh, yes.
And it was used, and I'm taking this information directly from your book, Strategic Heavy Bombardment Missions Against Enemy Targets.
Right.
And this is a phenomenal plane. It was equipped. Now, try to get a visual on this, ladies and gentlemen. It was equipped with 13 50-caliber machine guns, two chin turret guns under the nose. That was operated by the bombardier.
And
you had
one turret in the front, one turret in the rear, and one turret under the belly, and then one turret on the top. There were four turrets. Then, at the navigator's position and the bombardier's position, there were two machine guns that the navigator would accommodate himself with when it came into combat. The bombardier had the turret. Then the radio man had a gun up on top of the airplane that they had a little cradle and it would swing from side to side. Then you had two side 50 caliber guns, and that's how you got your 13 guns.
Amazing.
And there was a newspaper person many years back in the 30s, the late 30s, when the B-17 first came out, that he marveled at it when it came out of the hangar. He says, my God, that's a fortress.
Mm-hmm.
And that name remained, the Flying Fortress.
Well, you had what you called waste guns. They had 850 rounds of ammunition. The turrets had 1,250 rounds.
That's right.
I mean, it was a fortress. And how
many
B-17s were flying at that time?
Well, sometimes we had as many as 5,000. You know, my wife found it hard to believe, how could you have 5,000 airplanes in the air? I says, they had as much as 8,000 at times when the English put up all theirs and we put up all ours. That was
incredible.
Yeah. And it wasn't only that they were going to one target, because what they did was try to do a mysterious flight and keep the enemy guessing as to where they are really going. And they used to zigzag in the air.
Now, the B-17 not only had all of this ammunition, but it could carry up to 20,000 pounds of bombs.
Yeah.
And it could travel at 302 miles per hour. When you think of that time frame, that was a pretty significant speed, especially with all of that weight. And it could go as far as 3,750 miles if it was fitted with your Tokyo tanks, as they were called, the bomb bay tanks.
Yeah, what they did was remove the bomb racks
mm-hmm.
and install two tanks in there. And they were large tanks, similar to an oil burner tank when you feed an oil to an oil burner in a house.
Mm-hmm.
A tank of that nature was, so they had two of them there. And then they would load the bombs underneath the wings. But they didn't fly at 302 miles an hour. That was when the airplane was stripped. And we flew 210, 220, depending how high you are. The higher you go, the faster you can go, less air resistance.
Now,
so we're
going to
between
Excuse me, I hate to interrupt you. We're going to be going to break for just a moment. And my guest, Mr. Dishiavi, we are going to be coming back and chatting some more with him, and we'll share with you some experiences that he had. And this is in honor of Pearl Harbor Day. This is a very significant day of remembrance, and I think honoring those people that gave their lives, but also understanding what was going on at that time, it also enables us to have perhaps some compassion and understanding for our men and women who are serving overseas at this time. The cause of freedom is always there and always has to be fought for. This is Donna Sebo. We're coming back in just a moment to talk more about the Eternal Soldiers. We'll be right back.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717, ttap.com.
Hello, this is Donna, and we are coming back with our guest, Mr. Dishiavi, and the book, The Eternal Soldier, The Old Soldiers Don't Die and They Never Fade Away. We've been talking a bit about the planes that were flown and the fact that he was incarcerated at Stalag 17. Well, Stalag 17, as we mentioned in the first part of the interview, ended up being made into a movie, the story about same. And then there was a comedy series. And if ever you happen to see an old Stalag 17 comedy series or one of those shows, the guys are always trying to tunnel out. And Mr. Dishiavi, with that, there was actually attempts to tunnel out of Stalag 17. So this comedy that was done on television, this really was based on fact.
Oh, yes, certainly.
What was the success level of tunneling out?
There was no success at all, but everyone tried and tried. You see, we ran our camp like a democracy. We had a president. It happened to be that he spoke German, so it was in our good conscience to let him be the president because he can converse with the German soldiers. Now, if a person came up with a plan that he wanted to escape, he had to go before the committee. The committee had to approve it. And if they did approve it, then they would help them by rounding up all the GIs to chip in whatever they could as far as food is concerned or pieces of clothing or whatever. And that's how it would work. And now when they start, the biggest tunnel we had was started in the latrine. Now, can you imagine someone standing in a trench full of fecus and lime? Lime was put in there every day to quench the stench, so to speak. They would tunnel in from there, trying to tunnel out. And they'd go, and they knew exactly which way they were going. And this tunnel went out past the fence. Well, lo and behold, one day, I was one pick. There was 26 of us that were picked to march outside of the gates. As we got outside the gates, they handed us a long shovel. And we had to follow the guards. And they had dogs with them and all. And we went around, and they went past where the opening of the cave was, thinking that we would stop, showing them that we knew. But we went right by it. So they stopped us and told us to come back. And they said, we want you to dig here. Well, naturally, the minute we put the spade there, it all fell through.
Mm-hmm.
So they found. Now, that took months and months to build. And it was found out. And nobody ever knows how it was found out.
One of your points in your story was that a German guard that had been assigned to watch all of you day in and day out was someone that had come from your own neighborhood when you were growing up.
Yes. Hans. He was in charge of our barracks, 19 A and B. And he spoke better English than we did.
Amazing.
And we couldn't understand why, but he said he was teaching in a college in Brooklyn. He also had a ice cream parlor that his wife attended to in the morning until the early afternoon when he was finished with school, and then he would go and take care of the store until nighttime. And he got this beautiful embossed letter from Adolf Hitler to come fight for your fatherland, and he did. So he lost everything.
Being in Stalag 17, it was a pretty harsh and a pretty brutal environment. What kept you all going was the interaction you had with each other. But you did something that was exceptional. You really kept yourself in good physical shape. Now, the food was not the best in the world, but you did get packages from the Red Cross, which I wasn't aware that they even did that. So this was quite an education for me, but you got parcels from the Red Cross, and that enabled you to get through a lot of stuff.
Well, I only got 5 parcels. We were supposed to get 1 a week, and judging by the time I was there, I should have gotten 72 packages. Excuse me. Instead, we got a package now and then. And the commandant of the camp, Oberbürstlerin Kuhn, K-U-H-N, said, listen, when the railroad cars came in, the civilians who were starving, homeless, were raiding the trains and taking these packages. And we were lucky to salvage some of them. Now, that was their story. What else could we do or say? We had to accept it that way. They fed us every night a lot of potatoes. You wouldn't believe it. I went in there at 168 pounds, and I came out at 200 pounds. And people say, you were in a prison camp, and you came out 200 pounds? Well, we've seen pictures of people that come out as skin and bones. Well, if you weren't fed, that's just exactly what you would look like.
Mm-hmm.
But they fed us potatoes. A lot of rat's coffee, they called it coffee. We used to have horse meat once a month. So, and my mentality said to me, these guys don't have anything. How could they possibly feed you? Mm-hmm. They don't even have food for themselves. A lot of the GIs wouldn't accept that. They listen, I'm an American. I want good food. Well, my friend, you're a prisoner of war. So back off.
The first four steps.
That was my mentality. And I tried to round up as many boys as I could to let them join my club. I started a weightlifting club. I said, we've got to keep fit and strong, and especially our minds. And then, because I took up weightlifting, I did that at home. So I was the instructor there because I knew more than they did.
Mm-hmm.
We finally got a hold of someone, one of the prisoners, to teach anatomy. And I attended the anatomy class. And I passed 13 weeks of it. And they sent away to Switzerland, to the Board of Education in Switzerland, to make up a diploma so that we could have a diploma. And it was mailed to us. And I got my diplomas with me right now.
The first forced death march across Austria was with those of you at Stalag 17, and it was the first day of that was on April the 8th, 1945.
Correct.
And when you were on that march, it was just absolutely amazing, the experiences that you had. You came in contact with people that were part of the SS, and you said these had been trained starting at 12 years of age and were inducted into Adolf Hitler's special guards. These were people trained in such a way that they literally had no conscience.
Absolutely none. They disowned their family in order to be part of that group. That's what they were told. If you want to belong to this elite Hitler's group, the minute they mentioned Hitler, their god, they gave up their family. And they trained hard and just hated everybody outside of the SS troops.
Incredible.
And we had to be very careful, especially as prisoners, not even to eyeball one another, to look them in the eye, because they were known to just shoot you and just walk away like it was nothing, cold-blooded.
Wow.
So we try to avoid them as much as possible.
Now, in the book, you also showed the map of the death march. It took 18 days to complete. You walked about 17 miles a day, and the weather was hideous. It was 281 very, very difficult miles of marching in very, very bad weather. Now, let's go in. We've only got about a minute and a half here. The liberation. And that was on May 2nd at 6:30 p.m., 1945?
Yes.
And it was the 13th Armored Division that released you?
Yes. Our march ended at the Wilderhurst Forest. And that's where we lived for 5 days. And then we could hear the shooting in the background, knowing the Americans were getting closer and closer. And then one night, this jeep comes in, with this colonel standing up with his .45 holster, this gun holstered, and he says, you are no longer prisoners of war. You are American soldiers. And with those words, I still get tears now. It's what a feeling to be told that, you know, after 18 days of those mountainous, and we didn't even know where we were going. Were they going to kill us somewhere? Were they going to just leave us somewhere? No, they stayed right with us right there at the Wilderness Forest. And one of the guys who went down to the riverbank to get water in a rubber bag gave a cigarette to the guard that was with him. And the guard, because it was windy, turned around to light his cigarette, and the GI jumped into the water. And the current was so fast that he had clothing and all on. He went to the other bank. And when he got across there, the GIs was putting their guns up, ready to bombard that forest to make sure nobody was in there and to cross it, not knowing the Americans were there. So I said, look at this. All what we went through and to be killed by our own men, and no one would know why.
Mm-hmm.
So what a lucky day it was for us with that guy.
Yes, it was. Yeah. There's more in this wonderful book, The Diary of an Eternal Soldier, and I'm so glad, Armand, that you wrote this. because I think for the young people of today and for future generations to be able to see your experience through your written word and to be able to be aware of it, you've left a legacy that I think serves those who are serving at this time as well as those that have never, ever had the experience, and I hope they never, ever do.
I wouldn't wish it
on anyone because war is ugly. Now, do you have a website? I know we're just about out of time here.
Yes, it's armanddeshavi.com.
Okay, Armand, A-R-M-A-N-D, Deshavi, D-I-S-C-H-I-A-V-I.com.
And that'll bring up the book and little synopsis of it and give you an idea. I would like for these books to be in libraries and in schools. That's where they should be.
Yes, and also in the Flying Air Fortress Museums and in other museums around the country that honor those of you that had served. Armand, thank you so much for being my guest again, the Eternal Soldier. Old soldiers never die. They never fade away. Thank you for being my guest today.
Thank
this
you
is
so
Donna
much for
Stevens.
Having me.
We are going to be taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right, Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Ged Rose. Buy it today. 800-872-8852.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hello, this is Donna. Telephone lines are now open, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Today, for many of you listening, you may say, why even be concerned about Pearl Harbor Day? To me, because there were so many members in my family when I was growing up that had gone through the war, and there are many members of my husband's family that had experienced it as well, and so many of them are passing away, and we need to hear their story. If nothing else, to be aware of the fact of what we do not want happening again. And it is also important to understand their stories because it enables us to be able to walk in their shoes a little bit. And it's very tough to be able to see life through someone else's eyes, and that's the gift of writing. When you can pick up someone's book and you can, through the written word, be able to have an introduction, an awareness of what people went through, it really gives you pause and it makes you maybe feel even grateful for where you are, because a lot of the things we're experiencing today is because there were so many around the world who were dedicated to preserving what we value as our freedom. So to all the servicemen and women that are committing their lives and their energies to maintaining those rights and those freedoms, I want to salute you verbally, and I want to thank you, because you are very, very special. I, again, want to let you know the telephone lines are open if you would like to chat with me, 888-815-9756. Now, tomorrow, we're going to be talking about what's your body telling you. Steve Siskold has put together material that will enable you to be in tune with your body in a way that makes you alert when something's wrong. And I have some fascinating stories to share with you that a friend shared with me about their own personal experiences, and I think you'll really enjoy it. And that's tomorrow. And then the Wolf at Twilight, Kent Nerburn, is going to be my guest. He's going to be with us on Wednesday. And then one again, Linda McNabb, her own personal journey, written in a fictitious format, but written where maybe you would understand exactly what she went through to be able to find out who she is. And then on Friday, we're going to be talking about a cold case murder that ended up being solved by someone that had nothing to do with it, but had the investigative curiosity of a detective. And that individual is Thomas Ray Crowell, and we're going to be talking with him and his phenomenal book called The Passerby. So these are the people that are coming up. Now, I know we are coming towards the end of our program, and yesterday I'd given you a recipe, and this is a Paula Deen recipe, and I remember I happened to see this recipe given on air so long ago, and when I found it in a printed format, I thought, oh my goodness, I can remember laughing after watching the preparation on this, because this recipe came from a listener. It was a man that had developed the recipe, and it's sort of like a bread pudding, but it's made with crispy cream donuts. Now, right there, your image is sugar levels going through the ceiling. Well, I'm going to give the recipe out. I started giving the ingredients yesterday, and we ran out of time. So I want to do it now because I've got time now. So let me give it to you again. If you were making notes yesterday, great. If you want to make them right now, do it. Here we go. We've got 12 glazed donuts, and you cut them up into 1-inch pieces, big chunks. And you're going to have about 7 cups. And then you're going to need 8 slices of a potato sandwich bread or any white bread, you know, nice pieces of white bread. You cut them into 1-inch pieces, and day-old bread is perfect for this. It really is. So if you have some French bread or anything like that, you can use. You could even use sourdough if you wanted to. But that has its own flavor. So a good white bread. Try a wheat bread if you didn't want to use the white. Then you're going to need 1 can of apple pie filling. That's a 21-ounce can. 1 can of apple pie filling. And then you need 1 cup of raisins. You need a can of sweetened condensed milk. And if you're concerned about the few calories that might be exempted by using the fat-free, go ahead, be my guest. But my feeling is if you're going to do this, why not do it the right way? And then you're going to need 2 eggs, room temperature, remember, 2 eggs, 1/2 teaspoon of ground cinnamon, 1/4 teaspoon of salt. You're going to need 1/2 cup of heavy cream. If you don't have heavy cream, you can use evaporated milk. 2 tablespoons of confectioner's sugar. 2 tablespoons of confectioner's sugar. And 1 tablespoon of white rum. And if you don't have that, you don't have to put it in. You could use rum flavoring if you like. And you might want to have some strawberries if you wanted to put on a garnish. Now, this is the way you do it. I'm telling you, if you're concerned about calories, just write it down and don't fix it. But if you want to fix it and smile happily as everybody's oohing and aahing, make sure you take it to a place where there's a lot of people that can eat it. In a large bowl, you combine your donuts, the bread, the apple pie filling, and the raisins. In another bowl, you want to whisk together your milk, your eggs, your cinnamon, and your salt until it's smooth. Then you take and put your milk mixture right over your bread mixture, and you gently mix it until it's combined. And you let it stand for 10 minutes. And during that 10 minutes, just every once in a while, just go over and mix it. And this is so that the moisture is distributed evenly. And then you preheat your oven, and preheat it while you're doing the mixing, to 350 degrees. And you're going to use a 13-by-9-inch baking pan. And you spray that with cooking spray. You put your bread mixture into the baking dish. You press it down just lightly to remove air pockets. You bake it for 40 to 45 minutes until the center is set. And you lightly cover it with foil during the last 10 minutes if you find that it's browning too quickly. And then you cool it to room temperature. And then, of course, you can take your heavy cream, beat it with sugar until it's soft, and you know, mounding up very nicely. And if you want to add your rum flavoring, you can do that, or add the real stuff. And you beat it on medium-high speed until it gets real, real firm. And then you serve it with the bread pudding. Boy, I made it just under the wire with that. Ooh, just talking about it. Oh, my goodness. And I've got a French toast recipe that she gives it. I'm telling you, it tickles your taste buds, but, oh, it'll add inches to the hips. But what the heck? It's the holiday season. This is Donna Sebo. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. I just wish you well, and have a fabulous time preparing for the holidays. Whatever you're doing, be safe, be cautious when driving, don't be in a hurry, and don't get anxious. You got plenty of time to do everything you need to do. This is Donna Sebo. I'll see you back here, same time, same place, tomorrow. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.